McCurran versus Commonwealth, Mr. Cardani.
That's correct.
You have 15 minutes. Do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
I'll reserve 3 minutes, Judge.
Okay. You may begin whenever you're ready.
Judge, may it please the court, my name is Scott Cardani. I represent Shelby McCurran. And we have two errors before the court, which I really think dovetail one into the other. I think it's very clear that the motion to recuse being not allowed dovetailed into the sufficiency of the evidence argument. So even though they're two errors, I think they work together. I looked at the case law in this case, and I think it's very clear that this is kind of a newer case in that we've never had evidence in a civil trial and then the judge hear it in a criminal trial and then the recusal. Most of the case law I saw was either a remand or a similar criminal issue where it was a post-criminal thing like a revocation case, or it was where a Commonwealth attorney was the Commonwealth attorney in a case prior to, like in Jackson, where he came back as a judge in the motion to recuse. So this is a lot different. I think these are very, very important cases because my client's due process rights and his right to be innocent until proven guilty is so important and such a foundation of the law that when a court, as in this case, makes a ruling prior to that his credibility is not to be believed in a different case, in a civil case where it's preponderance of evidence was the standard, and then you go to reasonable doubt, he's guilty till proven innocent at that point, and that can't be the standard that we approach it with. So that's why we filed the motion.
Counsel, let me just stop you.
Absolutely.
Ultimately, what you have to show is that there's some evidence of bias. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
Where's the record indicate that?
The record of the bias, Judge, is actually in the fact that he said the exact same thing, basically, in the civil trial and in the criminal trial, which was, I don't believe the defendant.
We don't have that transcript, do we?
Well, Judge, I made it part of the record in the petition. I realized that the court didn't make it part of the record I didn't make it part of the record. I thought I did, but I guess I didn't in the motion to recuse. But I think at the Commonwealth's
assuming it's not part of the record, do we have evidence or proof of bias? And if not, where does that leave us?
I think we do, Judge. In my motion to recuse, we discussed this very thing. The judge says, it's in the motion, it's in his transcript during that recusal, which you certainly have. He talks about it. He talks about, look, I don't have anything. I don't remember this case. I don't have anything to say about it. I wouldn't remember this case, however he says it. But it's basically that kind of an argument that I don't have any bias because I don't remember the case. But yet he clearly remembers the case, and it clearly comes out in the transcript that he remembers the case in the trial transcript.
But then how do you get around the Slayton case, which essentially indicates that when courts develop opinions through the process of some sort of proceeding, that in and of itself does not indicate that they have to recuse themselves?
I think there's a difference, Judge. I think, number one, Slayton's a jury trial, and I think that makes a big difference because the judge at that point is not the trier of fact. So if he comes through some knowledge, the other thing is when that knowledge is material or it's foundational to the premise of innocence or guilt. Just because he has some information about the guy being maybe a prior criminal doesn't mean that he's going to be necessarily him being guilty in this case because of the facts. But when you say that he's unbelievable, he's guilty at that point and he has to prove himself innocent. It throws the whole thing upside down, and that's the distinction. Because we don't have that here. We don't have just a fact that some judge knew about him, maybe knew him prior. That's what most of the case law is. I knew him because I tried a case with him prior. I knew him because I convicted him on a prior case. But we don't have anything that I could find in any of the case law, Buchanan, Mason, State, any of those cases where it said he made the determination of a intent or is believability. And I think quite often the courts use this thing of, well, I discern his credibility not to be accurate, therefore the appeal's off and we get this closed door to the appeal room. But in this case, I think it's very imperative that you see the bias even in that. When he says, Ms. McKernan...
How is that any different, though, in a case where the court tries a matter, it gets appealed up to the Court of Appeals, and for whatever matter or reason is remanded, and that same judge tries it again?
I think that's a great, great question, Judge. The difference is, you're telling the court, you made a mistake in the application of the law. You need to rehear it. That's the whole reason we do.
But that court or jurist has still formulated some sort of opinion based on the witness testimony or the evidence.
He has, Judge, but now he has to. No, I don't think so at all, because I think the difference is, the distinction is quite frankly that this court told him, you've made an error in application of the law. You need to look at this differently. So he has to look at the case again through different eyes, or at least he's supposed to. And at least in there, there's some protection to my client or my potential client in the fact that the judge has to look at it through different eyes. And he has to apply either the statute or the interpretation of the statute differently to those set of facts. So on a remand case, I don't think it's even close to the same thing. I think it's completely outside of that and different. So, but again, I think one of the things that, like I said, I think in my sufficiency of the evidence argument, this thing of, well, once the fact finder finds incredibility of the witness, then we're all done. But when in this case, I think it's very clear when you read it, there's no evidence whatsoever of intent. And if he believes Ms. McKernan, which he says, that's what I choose to believe, her only statements for intent, was which my client said, was, I accidentally taped it. It was an accident, and I deleted it immediately. So there's no, okay, you find him incredible, but there's still no evidence of intent.
What about the testimony to his former employee that the tape he had about Ms. Hall was hot? I mean, couldn't there be something that's...
It's irrelevant, Judge. No, I don't think so, because he said, because his first statement is this, it was a mistake. It was a big mistake. It was an accident. And then he says something about, asks the question, well, she was hot, and he acknowledges that. But it's not like he went to the bar and went, man, I got these great videos. That would be different. I think you could make the application there. But I don't think that's the case here. He got questioned about it by his employer, said this is all a big misunderstanding. This was a simple mistake. And then the comment came after that. So there's not the same reference as if he went to the bar and he was drinking with his buddies and said, I got this great video of my hot niece down in the basement. You want to come see it? Or even if he says it's a great video, I have it. It's not the same. And you remember that witness particularly, Judge, I think it's very... on cross-examination, he was asked about his own problems with thinking she was hot. And he's the one that brings up the whole hot thing in anyways about her being hot. And he was looking at her Facebook page and all those kind of things. So he's kind of to me, he's kind of the creepy guy in the room who brings up to my client because my client has this accidental thing. So my client, that gets spun into my client's intent. I don't think you can do that. And I think you have to make that distinction. So for me... In this case, I think there's a great distinction to be made with all the cases. I mean, if you go through Deal and Green and Russell, they're all civil cases, civil to civil. So a lot of times, I understand that. I mean, I do it a lot of trial work. So a lot of times I've tried the custody and visitation in the juvenile court, and I have to go to the circuit court on the divorce, and I get that. And I just don't see any way around that. And I would love sometimes to have a different approach or a different judge or a different... And that was a bad example, actually. I mean, there's two different jurisdictions there. But, I mean, there's many times where I try the first part of a case with the judge and then come back and try the second part of the case with the same judge who's heard the evidence, you know, the totality of the evidence. But I think the standard's the same. The preponderance standard or beyond reasonable doubt is so much different. And it's such a cornerstone to the criminal law that I think without the impartialness of a judge going like, I take you as innocent. I mean, Ben Franklin said it best. Benjamin Franklin, actually, is Blackstone. But, you know, it's better for 100 to go free than one guilty man to suffer. And I think, for me, that's the cornerstone of this thing, this whole case.
Why aren't you kind of making a due process argument as opposed to simply just whether there's a bias here with the court?
Well, I tried to make both and put them together.
But what you're saying now is really more due process as opposed to simply just a bias that the court may have.
Well, I think, honestly, this is how I look at it. Maybe I'm wrong, but how I look at it is, when you're biased, you're taking away the due process rights of the client. When you automatically have had a bias against that client before he even takes the stand, before any evidence is put out against him, then that is taking away his due process rights.
Well, and
from
there's case law that speaks to that, but yeah, that's not an argument that's currently before us.
I agree. And I made separate arguments for that reason. I mean, for different reasons. I felt like this, again, for
it's
me...
It's good to make separate arguments. let's focus a minute on your recusal point.
Yes.
What do you do with the fact that the judge is presumed to know the law? And if, you know, that's a very well-established standard. A judge is presumed to know the law. The judge knows what the law is with regard to recusal, knows what the law is with regard to the burdens that the Commonwealth has in a criminal case versus a civil case. And... Where is the prejudice in this record?
I think it's
The bias, the prejudice.
I think it's replete, Judge, in the fact that he finds him guilty without a scintilla of evidence of intent. I think that's the bias. I mean, when you have no evidence whatsoever.
Well, doesn't that go more toward your sufficiency argument versus...
But that's my point. I think they dovetail because I think they're one and the same. When you look at this argument, I think that's the ultimate evidence of the bias or prejudice. When you have a case before the court that there is no showing of intent whatsoever, they can't even prove, the Commonwealth's evidence can't even say where the tapes came from or where the videos came from. There's no evidence... Because the judge says, I don't believe the game camera story, so if we take that out,
well, but there's nothing. Three different witnesses that testify in reference to the game camera. The fact that it wasn't in the bathroom when they were taking showers, there was nothing but a plug, and one said that, or two actually said they dried their hair.
Absolutely.
So given the standard of review as it relates to that testimony, the testimony about the tapes being out of sequence on the computer, how do we get around the standard of review for the sufficiency part of that?
I think it's really, again, simply because the wife also testified that she checked the bathroom and there are no other recording devices in the bathroom. So, again, that's where my problem is. Well, she didn't see any, but she checked the outlet, which was the obvious from the facts of the case is where it came from. It had to come from that particular place. No evidence whatsoever. I think it's... The other thing is... I want to answer your question before I go off. But the other point is the two experts both testified to these... things as because they had to carve and find these after they'd been erased and wrote over several times. That was the testimony of both experts, except for the information on the thumb drive, which only the wife had, which I would argue went through different hands, and there was all kinds of problem with chain of evidence there, even in the record. But both experts said that's very normal when you're carving. You're not going to get this perfect, if it's a videotape, you're not going to get this perfect thing come back out because they had to literally do this, perform this carving and get rid of all the erased material, all the metadata. They had to dig through the metadata otherwise and put this together, pieces that had been blown up basically in this computer and put it back. And they found it not on his operating system, as the wife said.
But on another system.
But on a backup drive. And it's really important, that fact, because the expert testified that if it would have been, as she said, it would have been in the trash can, it would have been easily recoverable. It would have just been right there. But it was nowhere to be found on that. They couldn't even find it using the same recovery tools on any of the other drives but this backup 8-year-old hard drive that had been put in the computer. And that's where they found it. So again, there's no evidence of intent anywhere in the record. And that, to me, is the prejudice and the bias of this case. And I realize I'm...
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Darren, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Leah Darren for the Commonwealth. I'd like to start very quickly going to something that other counsel has said and done this morning, and that what I have in quotes on my notes are that he says these issues work together, and he jumps from the recusal issue into the sufficiency issue. And this seems to me to be something akin to a cumulative error argument that warrants reversal in this case. And I just would simply argue to the court that's not proper. Each of these issues is to be decided individually. They rise and fall on their individual merits. We don't look at these issues cumulatively. Simply not proper. With regard to the recusal of Judge Sainer, this claim can be only considered to the extent that it was presented in the pretrial motion to recuse and in the arguments that were made on October 15th to the trial court, when he, at the conclusion of which he rendered his opinion. Other counsel has spent quite a bit of time in his brief and this morning talking about comparing what Judge Sainer said in this earlier...
We don't have that.
Absolutely not. So what I'm trying to get at is very much of what he's argued this morning is not proper argument before this court. This issue can only be considered to the extent it was raised pretrial and addressed pretrial. So when you look at the motion and the argument on that motion, the motion's at pages 53 through 54 of the record, And then we have the argument on the motion at pages 69 through 73. So that's seven appendix pages that the court really needs to hone in on this recusal issue. From those pages, we see there was a previous matrimonial issue. There was a different standard of review to be applied in that case.
If there is no evidence of evidence offered of bias, aren't we looking at an abuse of discretion standard?
Absolutely. We're looking at an abuse of discretion standard, and as the court, Your Honor, mentioned earlier, the court, Judge Thainer, says that theoretically, and I'm looking at page 71 of the appendix record, he says, Judge Thainer, in response to the motion to recusal, says theoretically the court can try the defendant and find him guilty, get reversed, and handle the case again on retrial. So that's the capital murder case of Justice in the Supreme Court, where that very fact occurred, and where there were certainly prior decisions made by the court in the earlier case that that's the basis of the kind of recusal motion that the defendant was making in this case. So the Supreme Court clearly rejected that in the Justice case. Counsel told the trial court there was no authority for his motion to recuse and that the decision rested squarely in the court's discretion. In responding to the motion, the court states the fact that there's definitely overlap in his jurisdiction of civil and criminal matters, that he says this is not uncommon. The court says it does what it needs to do. It hears each case individually, and it does not consider the two matters together. He keeps those issues separate. I'm looking at pages 71 through 72 of the appendix record, and the court concludes that it will not recuse himself. So the case law, which has also been discussed by the court this morning, is clear under the Slayton case. Expressions of opinion based on information acquired by the court in a prior judicial proceeding is not a basis for recusal. Court's familiarity with the parties, not a basis for recusal. An adverse ruling by the trial court is not a basis for recusal. Reliance on the canons of judicial ethics, which might indicate recusal would be warranted, is not a basis for recusal. So here we have a record which presents absolutely no factual basis for finding actual bias or prejudice. Again, he can't back into this argument by talking about what Judge Thainer said at the trial and comparing it to what he said at the earlier proceeding, because we don't have that record. That this case rises and falls on what is in the record. I've referred to that this morning, and it's our position that Judge Thainer did not abuse his discretion by refusing to recuse himself in this matter. With regard to the sufficiency of the evidence...
Before we move on to sufficiency, let me ask you one quick question with regard to something the appellant's counsel had to say. Are you aware of a case where a judge in one context says that a witness is essentially inherently incredible, and then here's a second case with that same witness?
I'm not aware of a case that presents exactly that factual pattern, but I think the court's decision in Justice, where the case has to go back, where the court's already made factual findings and the case goes back to the same judge for retrial, I think that case covers this situation. And then, of course, Slayton basically says the same thing, where you express an opinion in an earlier case. Just because you express an opinion in an earlier case is not a basis for recusal, absent actual bias or prejudice, which other counsel conceded in the trial court This was an abuse of discretion case, not a case where there was a showing of actual bias or prejudice. So, moving on to the sufficiency issue, if there are not additional questions, I would simply just point to the fact, again, much of other counsel's argument this morning was really the appropriate for the trial court. And he did make those arguments in the trial court, and they were rejected. So on appeal, the issue is, he says the evidence was insufficient to show that he didn't accidentally make these video recordings. And the record shows that two of the video recordings were of the defendant's niece showering nude. Those took place on November of 2013. We have a video of his children's au pair that took place on February of 2014. And we have the video of the caregiver's sister that also took place on February of 2014. These videos were not discovered by the wife until September of 2015, which contradicts a statement that the defendant made that as soon as he found them, he erased them. The computer experts testified that these videos were actually a series of one-minute videos, and the one-minute videos were numbered sequentially, and there were gaps in the numbering on those videos, which indicated editing. One of the videos of the defendant's niece was initially recorded upside down, and so that was edited by rotation so it could be viewed right side up. So we have that evidence of manipulation of the videos, in addition to the fact that they were on the defendant's computer at the time they were found by the wife. Then finally, we have statements that the defendant made to his friends that he'd been charging his game camera in the bathroom. That testimony was contradicted by the victims who uniformly said they saw no such thing in the bathroom. There was nothing plugged into the single electrical socket in the bathroom that they had to unplug in order to use hair dryers and curling irons and things like that. So the defendant testified that the videos were recorded accidentally, of course. Again, this was contradicted by other evidence presented at trial. And then, of course, since he testified, the trial court was not only entitled to reject his testimony, but infer from that testimony that he was lying to conceal his guilt. So we submit that the evidence in this case supported the convictions for unlawfully videotaping these young women, and we ask the court to affirm the convictions. Thank Are there you. Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel?
Thank you. I have about 2 minutes left. Let me make a distinction I think is very clear in the record. The videos that the Commonwealth's expert found were the ones on the zip drive that only the wife had in her possession, and the record was clear that that zip drive had been different from the time of the first expert to the time of the final expert. It had been messed with. It was only in her possession the whole entire time. That's her testimony, which the judge found to be credible. The other ones were carved from deleted material. So his testimony about them immediately being deleted absolutely fit the evidence 100%. It was exactly what said. When you look at those two testimonies, Laura Allman, which was the Commonwealth's attorney, and then our expert, both testified basically to the same thing, that when you're carving, it comes from a deleted file. You have to go back and put the metadata that has been blown up in the destruction of it and put it back together, and it's not going to become back together like this perfect line that it once was. It's going to have bits and pieces missing. So it all fits. I just think it's really interesting that the court said, well, I find her story to be completely credible and his not. And again, this is where there's insufficiency evidence. There was no evidence of intent then. If her statements were that he said that he did it by accident and deleted it, that's the only evidence we have of intent whatsoever in the trial. And quite frankly, with the two other girls, not the niece, the Morrison girls,
there was absolutely no testimony as those videos whatsoever. How they were created, other than the girl saying there was no camera in the bathroom, zero. And those certainly came from the metadata that was put back together that had been erased. So, again, there was absolutely no testimony whatsoever as to those two young ladies. None. And, again, this was all argued. You all read, we had a pretty good stand-up argument about this with the judge. We went over every piece of evidence over and over again and went back and forth. There is no evidence. So, yes, my insufficient evidence argument, something else, stands. This was a case that needs to be reversed. There was not sufficient. There was no evidence of intent whatsoever. Even if you say, I don't believe he did it on the game camera. The case law and the metadata and things like that have to show, just because you have it on your computer doesn't mean it was you put it there, you did it, or anything else. It doesn't mean that. So the only evidence we have that was said unbelievable by the court was my client said it was accidentally taped on a game camera. Absent that, there's no evidence of anything. There's no evidence. If we take that as the truth, then there's no other, or as a lie, then there's no evidence of any videotapes or where they came from whatsoever. So you can't pull that this was an intentional act on the part of my client. It just can't come together out of speculation. The court's allowed to put totality of the circumstances argued all the time. I mean, when you have different pieces, but here I would argue and suggest there are no pieces to put together whatsoever to form that.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
We'll come down and greet counsel and then hear the case of Cosby versus Cummings.